Good morning and welcome to Behind the Headlines. I'm Jennifer Napier Pierce with the Salt Lake Tribune. And today on the program, same-sex marriage, Park City Mountain Resort, Medicaid, the state fair, and more. And joining me this morning, Tribune reporter Mike Gorrell, who covers Salt Lake County. Mike, welcome back.
Well, thank you.
Also with the state government reporter Robert Gerke. Robert, welcome.
Good morning.
And courts reporter Marissa Lang, thanks for being here again.
Thank you for having me.
And you can join us too. What headlines caught your eye this week? You can send your questions and comments to the hashtag TribTalk on Twitter and Google Plus. You can put them in the comments section at sltrib.com, or you can call us. 801-355-TALK is our number. 801-355-8255. Marissa, I'll start with you. The week started off with a bit of a surprise, a federal district court judge weighing in on the gay marriage question in Utah. What happened?
Well, as you correctly stated, there was a federal judge who made a ruling that was kind of a surprise early this week, in which he basically said that the 1,300 or so couples who got married in Utah in that brief window when it was legal, all of their marriages need to be recognized by the state.
Okay. What was the particular case that was before Judge Dale Kimball?
It was the name of the case is Evans versus Utah, and it's named after a woman who lives in Utah, Joan L. Evans. And the gist of the case is that there are four couples who are married in that window, all of them same-sex couples, and they basically sued the state after the state announced its reluctance to recognize their marriage and give them the same rights as opposite sex couples who wed.
Obviously, gay couples, their supporters seemed very buoyed up by this news.
Absolutely, yes. It was definitely good news for the same-sex marriage lobby. They felt that it was, you know, the first time essentially since Judge Kimball's ruling back in December when he legalized same-sex marriage for that brief period, that they've been recognized and treated equally by the law in this state.
Hmm. I guess the question is, will the state appeal? How did Utah Attorney General Sean Reyes respond to this opinion?
There wasn't much of a response is the short answer. Sean Reyes and Governor Herbert basically said that they were reviewing it and they were discussing it and they haven't yet announced whether or not they will appeal it. I think the big question is one of whether or not they will succeed, and also if they do appeal, what does that mean, and on what basis do they have to appeal?
Hmm. Robert, Governor Herbert weighed in on the issue at his monthly KUED news conference yesterday, basically saying the state had a duty. It has a duty, yeah, to defend its laws.
Yeah. On pertaining to directly to the ruling, they've got, I think, 21 days. Is that right, Marissa, that the judge stayed the order? So, it's not going to take effect right away. They have a little bit of time to make the decision. The governor said he's going to meet with the attorney general soon and decide what course of action they're going to take. The governor has, was asked specifically about decisions by the governors in Pennsylvania and Oregon recently not to defend their same-sex marriage bans. And he said he feels like he has an obligation to defend the laws that are on the books. And so that might indicate that we're going to see an appeal. I think that's probably the likely course. He says the governor kind of put it in pretty vivid terms. He said a decision not to defend the laws of the state would be a step toward anarchy. There are on the opposing side, groups like Equality Utah say, well, there's also an obligation to defend the U.S. Constitution. And if under the 14th Amendment, that these bans are unconstitutional, then you have an obligation not to defend them. So that's sort of the tension there. I think we'll probably see some answers to these questions probably in the next week or so.
Mm-hmm. As Robert alluded to, I mean, Utah's not in an isolation booth. These rulings keep coming out, and we had a few more this week. Can you sort of recap what's going on around the nation for us?
Sure. So basically, bans on same-sex marriage are falling around the country like a stack of dominoes. Since I think June or like recently there of last year, rather in the last year, there have been 18 different states whose same-sex marriage bans have been challenged and subsequently overturned in a court. So, I mean, we're talking about a lot of states, and at this point, it's reaching sort of a critical mass where every week it seems we're hearing about a different state, a different ruling, a different judge, and they're all going the same direction, which is overturning any bans on same-sex unions.
Mm-hmm. And, of course, we're all sort of waiting here in Utah for the Tenth Circuit to rule on the Utah case. Any
every time
any
you
noise
ask me,
there?
Yeah, it's the same answer. Any day now, we could get a ruling any day now. The Tenth Circuit, of course, has been pretty quiet about the goings on in the Kitchen versus Herbert case, which is the same sex marriage case that originally overturned Utah's Amendment 3 ban on same sex marriage. That could come any time, but it is widely expected that they're going to make a ruling both on Utah and Oklahoma, which it also heard around the same time. So we're going to probably get two for the price of one when the 10th finally comes out with a decision.
Mm-hmm. And did the governor say directly, did he comment at all on the direction, the general trend that's going around the nation?
Well, I mean, he said that ultimately it's going to be in the hands of the Supreme Court to decide this. You know, he said there's disagreement, obviously. But yeah, I mean, as Marissa pointed out, they all seem to be breaking the same way. And it's state courts and federal courts, and it's in very conservative states. You've got Arkansas and Kentucky and Idaho and Utah and places like that. You know,
South Dakota,
Texas, I believe, was one of them. You know, these are red states, you know, and so. But, you know, as the governor pointed out, ultimately, this probably will end up in the hands of the Supreme Court to decide. And then we'll have answers and go from there is sort of how he put it.
And Utah, I don't think, is going to stop until we get to the Supreme Court. I mean, we are definitely one of the states that's going to push it all the way.
Did he talk about the money question? How much is this costing the state to defend Amendment 3?
He didn't talk specifically about it. In the past, he's kind of said, you know, it's going to cost what it costs, you know, because as he put it the other day, you know, he feels like he is sworn to defend the Constitution. That Amendment 3 is a constitutional ban on same-sex marriage, and so he feels obligated to pursue that, you know, regardless of the cost.
Hmm. Really interesting discussion. Let's move on to Medicaid. Another interesting conversation. Yeah. State lawmakers this week gave their two cents on the Medicaid question. Robert, what did they say?
Well, the House leadership and Senate leadership both met, and their decision, their preference at this time is to not act on expanding Medicaid. The question they have right now is there's federal money on the table. Do they want to take some of that federal money and use it to cover about 111,000 people who make less than 138% of the poverty level? It's for an individual, it's about $15,000. So pretty low-income people, I mean, that can't afford to buy insurance. So the money's there if they want to take it. The governor's trying to hash something out with the U.S. Department of Health to, you know, find something that they can agree on and to cover those folks. The House has been reluctant to expand it. The Senate, you know, kind of has partial expansion in mind. But right now, they both seem inclined to not want to do anything until they meet in a general session. They don't want to come in a special session this summer like the governor had envisioned, you know, do a one-day kind of sign off on it and put it into effect. They would rather tackle this after January when they meet in the general session, which means, you know, it could be another 6 to 9 months before this thing actually starts getting implemented. We could be late 2015, if not early 2016, before these people get coverage. And in the meantime, there's about $4 million a month that the state is sort of foregoing. You know, they're paying into the Medicaid fund, but they're not drawing it out. So critics are pretty adamant that they should, and Democrats and health advocates are pushing for them to go ahead and take the money and cover these folks that are currently uninsured.
Hmm. As you alluded to, the governor has been working with the feds on an alternative to expanding Medicaid, basically getting those federal dollars here, but then allowing people to buy their own insurance on the open market. Will the legislature's action this week impact that effort at all?
It probably won't impact the negotiations. He's going back there next month to meet with the Secretary of Health and try to come up with something that they can bring back and show to the legislature.
But he still needs that legislative stamp?
But yeah, under a law that they passed last year, in 2013, The legislature has to authorize any expansion of Medicaid. So he will need their, you know, and they also have to appropriate. There's state funds that have to go into this, the administration side of it as well. So they have to be involved in it. And so without their support, he can't really do much of anything. He said he's still confident or hopeful, I guess, that, you know, once he comes back with a concrete plan that they can digest that and authorize it this summer. That may be optimistic, though, given that, you know, both House and Senate leadership seem pretty reluctant to do that at this point.
And it's interesting that our colleague Kristen Stewart wrote a story. I believe it's in today's paper, if my memory serves right. The resistance of lawmakers is really not widely supported. Overwhelmingly, Utahns support expanding Medicaid.
Right. More than three-fourths support some sort of expansion, either the proposal that the governor has proposed, which would, as you mentioned, take the federal money and then put it into private insurance policies, or the regular general expanding Medicaid and putting them on a government program. Three-fourths of the population support that. Only 13%, I think, supported not doing anything. So that's and another thing that's kind of noteworthy about this population, this 111,000 people that are not covered, most of these are working poor. There was a study that said more than half, I think it was almost two-thirds, were working poor who had jobs, were working regularly, and just couldn't afford to buy the insurance because they weren't making enough.
In your story, Senate President Wayne Niederhauser is quoted as saying that this issue is too big to be dealt with in interim. Did he say why lawmakers didn't address this in the session that just ended?
Yeah, well, there were competing plans. I mean, the governor had his proposal that came out a little bit late in the session. You know, the speaker wanted to use purely state money to try to pay for some of the direct medical costs, basically just reimburse medical providers with state money. And the Senate kind of wanted a partial expansion up to about 100%. But they couldn't come together. I mean, the Senate, the House, the governor, they all had these competing plans, and they couldn't get on the same page. And so, that's why they couldn't do it, you know. And even if they had done it, they'd still have to go through this process of getting approval from the Department of Health. So, can they come to an agreement in the coming months? That's a pretty big question, you know. Even if the governor comes back with a proposal, the House has been, House leadership at least, has been pretty reluctant to take any more federal money on this. And so they would rather, you know, the Speaker was in particular pretty adamant that she just doesn't want to get any more federal, you know, any more reliant on federal money for this program. So there's a long way to go on this one, I think, still.
How much of this is election politics at work? I mean, well, I know Speaker Lockhart has not officially declared that she's running for governor in 2016, but it's widely accepted. The governor has also given some indication that he wants to run again. I mean, she's sort of drawing a line in the sand, and he is too.
Right, right.
Is that where the stalemate's coming from?
Well, I think that's a pretty logical assumption. You know, I mean, the speaker has not ruled out running for governor in 2016. The governor, the presumption is that he probably will. So, you know, these two are going to be combatants, if they're going to be combatants in 2016. I mean, the governor was asked this question just yesterday, and he said, you know, there probably is politics in politics, right? And so there probably is some element of that. You know, whether that's what is driving this, whether politics is overriding policy is another question, I guess. But, you know, there's a significant disagreement. And the friction point, as it has been in the last several months in a lot of different topics, it appears to be between the speaker and the governor.
Meanwhile, 111,000 Utahns without health care?
Without health care and for the foreseeable future. I mean, we're talking another 18 months probably before they can anticipate getting any help.
Mm. Salt Lake Tribune reporter Robert Gerke, also with me in studio, Marissa Lang and Mike Grell. And you're listening to Behind the Headlines here on KCPW. You can join us as well. The number, 801-355-TALK. 801-355-8255. We're talking about the week's headlines. You can also send us a tweet to the hashtag TribTalk. We need to take a quick break. We'll be right back. Stay with us. Welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm Jennifer Napier Pierce of the Salt Lake Tribune, and joining me this hour, Tribune reporters Marissa Lang, Robert Gerke, and Mike Grell. And you can join us by sending a tweet to the hashtag TribTalk. You can also put your comments at sltrib.com, or you can give us a call. 801-355-TALK is our number. 801-355-8255. Mike Gorrell, let's go to as the ski resorts turn. It seems like there's a bit of drama always in the industry, and the latest is Park City Mountain Resort in a legal tussle with Talisker Corporation, which operates the canyons. This week, a judge ruled in favor of... Talisker and Vail. Why?
Because, well... for a lot of reasons. There were 9 motions involved in this ruling that Judge Ryan Harris handed down that basically involved the case in which Park City Mountain Resort had leased its mountainside since it started, basically, from the company that Talisker eventually bought out all those rights. That lease came due at the end of April of 2011. Park City Mountain Resort didn't renewed in time, found out about it later, kind of backdated some documents to make it look like they had done it in time. And then initiated a lawsuit against Talisker saying, you didn't let us know that this lease was up. And we were making big investments on that property in order with the idea that we are going to be here for a long time. But the judge said, well, you know, you missed that deadline for that lease. It's theirs. And so Talisker, what it plans to do is turn over that property to Vail Resorts, which it brought in last year to run the canyons. And so probably not this next season, because Park City Mountain Resort is going to appeal the decisions. And so that'll take another year to get that all resolved, and things will go on as normal. But after that, there's the definite possibility that Park City Mountain Resort and the canyons are one.
Both sides were a bit testy in their comments to you on how they reacted. Can you just recap for us?
Well, they don't get along at all. And, you know, John Cumming, who's the president of Powder Corp, the parent company of Park City Mountain Resort, has basically said that even if this court ruling went against us, we're not going to give up. We still own the base property at Park City Mountain Resort, so you, Vail, and Talisker, you can't get your people up on our mountain, that mountain, without going through us. And by God, we're not going to give it up. It's not for sale, and you can't use it. And the Talisker Vail response was basically, come on, give it up, guys. Every time you turn around, the courts are ruling against you. You lost. You screwed up. You lost. Now all you're doing is threatening the economic vitality of the Park City community by threatening to shut down Park City Mountain by not providing access. Now, come on, get over it. Let's work out a deal and move on.
So they're willing to sit at the table, the settlement table again, or?
Oh, they both say that they're willing to sit at the settlement table.
It sure
table
doesn't sound like it, though.
I know, and they both say that we're the ones that are willing to make reasonable offers, and the other side has just come back with unreasonable demands. And, you know, that's a good back and forth that we can't know on the outside how legitimate either of their claims are.
A lot of posturing. PCMR, of course, crucial to Park City's finances. And how did locals react to this news?
Well, they're pretty close-mouthed, too, about it.
Really?
Because,
why?
Well, because they're two big players in their community. And they're like all the Chamber of Commerce and the city people, they don't want to take a side until it's all resolved, because they're afraid of offending either group. And so I'm sure that this is the kind of thing that people talk about in bars and at restaurants and stuff, and have definite high opinions on, until a newspaper reporter or somebody comes by and says, can I put that on the record? And then they say, we hope they resolve it in time.
Right.
For everyone's good.
I mean, in some ways, I wonder if people are loyal to PCMR, or they just want a functioning, well-run ski resort in the heart of Park City. Do you think?
Yes. I think there's certainly some loyalty there. There's a lot of people who stick with resorts through thick and thin over decades, and they love their resort. There's probably just as many people that just want something that functions well, and they don't really care which one of the rich fat cats out there own them.
Right. All of this, of course, coming the week just a week after PCMR owners, the Cumming family, announced that they are buying Snowbird. Is this going to affect Snowbird, the Snowbird deal at all?
Well, there's been some speculation that this would be the perfect out for the Cummings. They could get out of the Park City area by selling that base property to Canyons and Talisker for a pretty hefty sum of money, and then applying that to the whatever purchase price they have made to get a 51% or a majority interest in Snowbird, and then to further that down the road and buy out Dick Bass and his family altogether. So it could figure into that, but that's one of those things that remains to be seen.
But there's no indication that the Cummings would withdraw from the Snowbird deal.
Oh, no. I think that's the way that they can stay involved. It had been speculated early on that this might be one of the ways for them to really maintain their presence in the Utah ski industry without having to, you know, without Park City Mountain Resort.
Mm-hmm. Are other ski resorts commenting on this? What about Ski Utah?
No, they didn't comment either.
Okay. No reaction there.
Yeah, because it's two of their biggest members.
It's all in
members.
The family, right. Yeah. So where does this leave skiers come snow season?
Well, I'm pretty sure that nothing is going to change this season. That because of the appeals process, that Park City Mountain Resort will be going ahead with its season pass sales. And that might make some of those people pretty nervous about whether just the off chance that they'd buy a season pass and it would get shut down. And so I think that overall most of those loyal members would still stay with them. What it could end up doing, though, is helping to boost the Epic Pass sales that Vail has. Its discounted prices end next week. It's like $729 for a season's pass, and so that's still a really good deal. And I wouldn't be a bit surprised if some Park City Mountain Resort people who aren't really especially loyal to the brand and just like the mountain might end up getting Epic Passes instead.
All right, stay tuned. The drama continues on the mountain. Let's move to the prison. Marissa, talk of moving the prison out of Draper has resumed. And you were at a meeting yesterday where some consultants presented their assessment. What did they say?
So they basically laid out what Utah's options are for moving and not moving the prison. And what they said was the option to not move the prison isn't much of an option at all. It's going to be expensive. The facilities in Draper are not holding up. It would cost hundreds of millions in repairs. So ultimately, in the grand scheme of things, their recommendation was to move the prison and to do it pretty soon. They said not a hard deadline, but their suggested deadline was to start construction on a new prison site by 2018 and to have it up and running by 2021. So we would have a basically fully functioning new prison by that date.
How much to move? Many millions, but
To move, it's in the $1 billion range, actually.
$1 billion, okay.
And to not move, it's not too far behind. It's about $783 million, I think, was the price tag that they discussed yesterday. So, and that is just in the next 20 years. I mean, if you extend it further out, you just have to take into account further growth and further decay as well.
Who were the consultants?
So it's a firm called MGT. And they were selected out of a RFP process in which there were several firms that competed. And both of the gentlemen who spoke at yesterday's Prison Relocation Commission meeting have extensive experience in law enforcement evaluation and similar type projects where they, you know, moved prisons or built jails and things of that nature.
Okay. So any possible locations mentioned yesterday?
Nothing concrete. They did talk about some very general criteria that they would like. I mean, moving the prison is no small undertaking. In Draper, it's a 700-acre property that they have out there. So you need a place with space. You also need a place, they said, that is convenient. They believe that moving it too far out of the main artery of Utah, so to speak, would be detrimental, not only for people and families who might want to go visit their loved ones, but for the prison itself, because the prison relies on, you know, medical personnel, lawyers. They have to get their inmates to and from court. There's a huge network of volunteers. I learned a fact yesterday that Utah actually has the largest volunteer network in its prisons than any state in the country. So it would be a really difficult thing to put it out in the middle of nowhere that's hard to get to and really far away from highways or public transit of some sort. So that's a big consideration. Also, you have the space issue. Also, you want to avoid something that's going to be environmentally detrimental. They said wetlands, not a great idea.
Sure.
Things of that nature. So there's a lot of factors going forward. They didn't cite any specific places, but they did say, okay, this is what we're looking for.
I can't believe there's no short list, though. That seems so crazy. I mean, you've got these really specific requirements. There's probably only like three or four places that meet those criteria.
There might be. I don't know them off the top of my head, but I think the next step is to come up with a short list. They're trying to get a short list, and they want to narrow it down, I think, to a very small number or one going into the next legislative session that they can then go to lawmakers and say, this is where we're looking at.
What's the scuttlebutt, Robert? Have you heard of any possible locations?
Well,
out there?
There's they toured some potential sites. I can't remember if it was before the session or during the session. You know, Tooele County, for example, has been kind of jockeying for it. They've expressed some interest in it. I think Box Elder County was interested in it. You know, and there's talk of maybe putting it down by, you know, there's already a facility down in Gunnison, so you've got some places, you know. So there are some potential sites, and, you know, it kind of, as Marissa mentioned, there's a lot of criteria that they have to evaluate to decide which one they want to focus on. You know, and as she mentioned, the you know, it's also for the inmates there, they want them close to family, and they need the support service, and they need workers, they need guards able to get to these places. I think she's right. They're going to kind of hone in on it a little bit over the next 6 months or so, and probably have some place, at least a short list that you referred to before the session starts.
Sure, Mike.
As a Salt Lake County reporter, I'm really interested too in what they do with the 700 acres out there.
Oh yes,
you can just see the sharks circling that. That property and trying to take advantage of it and make a killing off of it. So have they been talking much about that at this point?
Yes, they did mention that. That was actually shortly after mentioning how much moving the prison was going to cost, which I think a lawmaker said, you know, kind of gave them hives. they talked about how much that property might yield in selling it. And I think the price...
So they're hoping to recoup some of the
costs?
Right.
They're hoping that in selling that property, they are going to get a lot of their money back and perhaps more. I think they assessed its value at $1.8 billion.
Well, there's a talk in that whole area from the Draper Front Runner Station all the way into northern Utah County to try to turn that into a kind of a Silicon Valley with high-rises and all kinds of economic development engines out
high-tech
there.
High-tech corridor.
Yeah, I mean, if you think back, this whole thing kind of got put on front burner a couple years ago when, you know, because they've been talking about moving the prison for, back during the Huntsman administration and before. And it kind of got put on the front burner when some developers came up with proposals to try to do just that, you know.
Terry Deal,
and Al Mansell and some others, you know. And so you know, and Draper's put together these drawings of, you know, what they envision. It's like, it's remarkable. I mean, high rises, density, you know, dense development, sort of high tech hub they want to make.
Silicon slopes.
This sort of very ambitious development proposal. And so, yeah, I mean, there's a lot of money at stake here, and somebody's probably going to get very wealthy doing it, I suspect.
Who decides, though? I mean, is it this prison relocation commission that's going to make the parcels available, or who's going to do that?
They're going to make recommendations. I think ultimately it comes down to the legislature, and they're going to decide what to do. The commission's job is really to come up with a course of action, a plan, suggestions, that shortlist we talked about, and kind of start implementing the steps we need to get the prison moving.
Hmm. One thing that I'm curious about, is corrections policy part of this discussion at all? I mean, are they talking about programming changes or changes in sentencing philosophy? I mean, these are all sort of peripheral issues that have been talked about by policymakers for a long time. Will a new facility sort of accommodate a change in direction as well?
Certainly. So Roland Cook, who is the director of the Utah Department of Corrections, he is actually on the Prison Relocation Commission. And he spoke quite a bit yesterday about where the Department of Corrections is at right now with a lot of those things, with programming and what they are able to offer their inmates. And also he discussed what they would like to improve upon and prioritize in moving into a new facility. I mean, when you're starting from scratch, you kind of have the ability to say, okay, we're going to emphasize this and we're going to improve this. And so he did discuss he wants a greater emphasis on work training programs. The prison is, you know, currently involved. Its inmates are working in various capacities. There's a furniture program and I wrote about a dog service dog training program. So there's all kinds of different things going on there that inmates can participate in. He wants to expand that, and he wants facilities that are more tailored toward helping inmates build skills that so when they are released back into society, it's marketable and they can, you know, kind of take those skills and apply them to real work jobs. He also talked about mental health treatment and substance abuse treatment. It's been said that our prisons are the greatest, you know, caretakers for our mentally ill and addicted populations. So they want to have, again, more tailored facilities for those inmates who are mentally ill or have substance abuse problems. And yes, the list kind of goes on. This conversation about moving the prison actually is kind of running parallel to another conversation about reforming our criminal justice system. And there is a big concentration on recidivism rates and what causes offenders to reoffend, what is bringing people back into this rotation of in and out of the system, basically, and what can we do to kind of help people not only get rehabilitated, but reacclimated to society after being removed from it for so long.
Can you also, are they also talking about demographics? What kind of growth are we expecting to see in the corrections field? And what about changing demographics? I understand there's a growth of women inmates too.
Sure, yes. There's going to be a pretty big growth across the board. And that does mirror population projections for the state and for the nation at large. But yeah, we're going to see more female inmates probably. There's the facility down at Draper, the Tippinogis Women's Facility. I forget the number off the top of my head, but it houses quite a few women, and we're expecting that number to grow pretty substantially. And I think they cast their projections out pretty wide. I think they gave us numbers for the next 20 years or so, but you know, if you think about it, that's not too far off.
Mm-hmm. And one of the things they mentioned during the legislative session at one of the presentations I went to that is that even if you rebuild the prison, you're still going to need to contract for more county jail beds. You're probably going to need another pod down at Gunnison just to kind of keep pace with the growth in the prison inmate population right now.
And they are actually at, or the proposal is to add another wing down in Gunnison right now, and mm-hmm. they did discuss adding jail beds. I mean, they do have prison inmates right now who are in county jails all across the state.
So is there a to-do list? What's the process from here?
The process is they're going to identify these criteria that we talked about, of which it sounds like they have a pretty decent idea of what they're looking for, and then they're going to start looking at sites. They're going to start looking at locations and places. And as Robert mentioned, there are communities that are gunning for this prison that are waving their arms and saying, oh, we're here. Mm. So they're going to start taking a look at that. And I was told yesterday that some legislators have actually been getting phone calls from private citizens who are offering up their land to help with the prison. So, I mean, there's all kinds of people who are saying, hey, look, I've got land, and what do you think? So they're going to start taking a look at those offers and taking a look at things that may not have been apparent right away and seeing what the best route might be.
As you mentioned, Mike, a lot of dollar signs looking mm-hmm. That people are thinking about. Let's move on to the state fair, the Utah State Fair, a showcase for livestock, agriculture, many oddities for generations. Robert, you're
Butter
reporting
cow.
This. Yes, indeed. You're reporting this week that a big question mark hangs over its future. What's going on?
Right. Well, so the state fair ran into a problem recently where they kind of overbuilt. They tapped into some reserves to sort of upgrade some facilities and, you know, put some bells and whistles on it. And then the attendance at the fair just tanked because they had bad weather. And so they came up with a huge shortfall. They had to go back to the legislature to get an additional appropriation of, I believe it was about $600,000, mm-hmm. on top of the roughly $700,000 they get each year from taxpayers anyway. So it's raised questions about whether, you know, in conjunction with that, there are these two barns that are sort of essential to the fair, these huge barns that have just been allowed to fall apart. They've been condemned now because they're in such poor condition. And so there's the legislature now is looking at, in addition to that, there were two audits done that raised questions about the management, purchasing practices, and so forth of the state fair.
I feel like I should be playing some sad carnival music while we talk about this. Couple audits. What do they show?
They raised questions about the long-term sustainability of the model they've got without additional taxpayer support, attendance slipping steadily, and just, you know, sort of raised management questions about the way the fair's been run. So that has legislators looking at what they're going to do with the future of this. And there were several proposals given to the legislators in this audit. One of them was to sort of co-locate it with the Salt Lake County Fair. One of them is to privatize it. One of them is to keep the fair park but privatize the operations. So they're kind of looking at this and trying to decide long term what it's going to do. And as with the prison, it's in a pretty sought after spot, this land that they've got there. I mean, it just, you know, just west of downtown. And, you know, they could sell that land and probably make a decent amount of money on it and move the fair somewhere else. South Jordan has expressed some interest in it. Salt Lake County Fairgrounds, you know, they could co-locate. Senator DeBacchus had a proposal to have it travel, you know, go county to county each year, you know, and sort of be an economic magnet for those areas. So there's some serious questions about it. Right now, there's a three years left on the lease for the fair park, and the state has to renew that. But the director of the facilities and management for the state says he can't, by law, he can't renew the lease until they've shown him a viable business model, which he hasn't seen yet. Mm-hmm. So,
Mike Rell, what do people at the county complex think about this? Are people talking about the county or the state fair at all?
I haven't heard anything over at the county about it, but what Robert said makes a lot of sense.
The city wants to keep it in, you know, keep it where it is. They were there at the hearing the other day and expressed support for keeping it where it is. Obviously, legislators from that area want to keep it where it is, and a lot of the rural legislators want to keep it where it is because they think it's a link between the urban and rural parts of Utah's history, I guess, you know,
sure.
Utah's culture. And they're big supporters of it and obviously have been to, you know, $700,000. That the subsidy that this fair is getting now is one of the highest in the region, and the attendance is among the lowest in the region. Now, one of the senators pointed out that that's a little bit of a misleading comparison because, for example, I believe Idaho has horse racing up there that's a big draw, and we obviously don't do that here in Utah. So there are some similarities and differences, I think, between neighboring states. But they're gonna have to take a careful look at this in the upcoming session and decide what they want to do with the future of that operation.
It's interesting in your report, some of the testimony was pretty negative. People who even attended were not, they didn't come away smiling, really.
Yeah, you know, one of the legislators said he took his grandkids there and they had to park several blocks away and, they couldn't find parking. And when they got there, it's like, you know, they looked, there wasn't much to see and it was a disappointing event. I haven't been to the fair for a few years, full disclosure, so I can't vouch.
Well, I have, and a turkey bit my son's finger.
Well, there you go.
It was his fault, but anyway.
Now they've got a lawsuit on their hands. So, I mean, the attendance has, you know, the chart, if you chart the attendance, it's steadily dropped for over the last 15 years, I think, you know, and so they're going to have to do something to keep this viable, and it seems unlikely that they can make it self-sustaining. It's probably going to continue to require some taxpayer subsidy.
But there's not talk of getting rid of it altogether.
They haven't talked about getting rid of the state fair altogether. No, most of the talk was, do we keep it where it is? Do we move it someplace else?
Uh-huh.
And there was some talk of hiring a private contractor to operate the fair. And I don't know. There were a couple other states that had done that, so it's not unprecedented. Frankly, the legislature has a appetite, I think, for privatizing a lot of things. That may be an attractive option for him. One of the benefits of that the auditor cited was it gets the state out of competition with the private sector for that sort of event. You know, I mean, obviously there's not private sector state fairs, but you know, that sort of event. They've got it teed up now. I think they've got the issues in front of them, and there's a report that there's a contractor that's been hired to do a master plan report for the fair that will be done. I believe it's in June, at the end of June. I think they'll probably present it in early July. So we may have a little bit better idea about what the options are there and have a little bit better data in front of us then.
Mike Correll, the Salt Lake County Fair has also had struggles. I mean, maybe this is just fair.
Right. Part
this
of
is part of the issue that all fairs are yeah. dealing with.
I don't know if it's all fairs, but certainly probably part of the urbanization of Utah, that there's far less attachment to the land than there might have been 30 years ago when there were a lot more farms in the Salt Lake Valley and so forth. I think Salt Lake County might even enter this fray with the equestrian park out in South Jordan. The county's been pumping money into that for a number of years now, trying to get it fixed up, and they know that they need more people out there, and pulling in the state fair might be a really nice way to do that. So,
talking about the week's news, and we invite you to join us as well. 801-355-TALK is our number. You can also put comments on the website, sltrib.com. We'll be right back after another break. Stay with us. Welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce with the Salt Lake Tribune. And joining me in studio, Marissa Lang, Robert Gerke, and Mike Gorell from the Trib. And you're welcome to join us as well. The number 801-355-TALK is our number. 801-355-8255. You can put your comments at sltrib.com or send us a tweet. And the hashtag is TribTalk. And we've only got a few minutes left, but Mike Gorell, I want to ask you about an issue that's been brewing for quite some time. The county DA's office, the district attorney's office, they'll be getting a new building. What's happening?
Well, this week, Mayor Ben McAdams announced that the county had reached a deal to purchase 3.1 acres at the intersection of 5th South and Main Street, just west of Matheson Courthouse, from the LDS Church's holding company, Property Reserve, Inc. So they will now proceed with building a building there right next to the courthouse where all the DA's attorneys can be located, and probably some state attorney generals as well.
This has been an issue that's been talked about for quite some time now. What's the backstory?
Okay, it's been going on for about 5-6 years now, where there was a bond was issued by the county years ago to build this building. It was for $31 million, the bond. But as time passed and it didn't get done, and there were efforts to make it a really, really, really good environmentally sensitive building with net zero, the price escalated up to $50 million, and that really concerned some of the members of the council that there wasn't money available for that. And there was also another concern that they're putting that much money into downtown Salt Lake when the population shift in the valley is way to the south and to the west. Mm-hmm. And that rather than spending tons of money to build a mega complex for its attorneys downtown, that the DA should be putting more money into developing a facility in West Jordan.
So what's the timing on this project? Do we know?
I don't know precisely yet. I would imagine that we're talking about getting an RFP out within the next 6 to 9 months, probably like that. Construction starting a year from now, maybe a year and a half, and then that'll probably take 2-3 years.
So is this a victory lap for Mayor McAdams? Or who's taking credit?
McAdams Sim Gill, you know, they've all been working a long time to try to get this deal done, and it seems like they've finally reached on something that really works. The previous site that they had in mind at 6 South and State Street was about an acre smaller, and the DA's office would have had to either buy more property or rent more parking, and then that would have been an ongoing expense that they didn't want to incur. So I'd say that all the county people are pretty happy about it right now that they can get it done. But there still will be a fight about how environmentally advanced this building might be. And I think that you're going to see the McAdams administration scale it back a little bit. It'll still probably be a LEED Gold certified building, but it won't be net zero.
Okay. We're going to keep an eye on that one. Let's finish today's program with the underplayed story of the week. This is a sleeper story, a story you guys think might have some legs in the future. And Mike Gorrell, what's your pick?
Right now we're entering the last month before Salt Lake City has to adopt its budget for next year, and there are a couple of big items on it that still must be resolved by the council. One is the council going to go along with Mayor Becker's proposal to eliminate $25,000 for fireworks at Liberty Park and Jordan Park on the 4th and 24th as an air quality measure?
Ooh, that's a big one.
Yep, and then they also have to decide about golf, because the golf courses are going to break even this next year, they predict, but that'll still leave them $500,000 in the hole. So they are talking about closing the Jordan River par 3.
Golf and fireworks? That's mom and apple pie right there. Okay, I think you're right. We're going to hear more about that. Okay, Robert, what's your pick?
Well, this one got a fair amount of attention this past week, but President Obama declared a national monument down in southern New Mexico. Mm-hmm. And when he did it, he said he's not finished yet. He hinted that there's going to be more down the road. The Navajo Nation has been advocating for a big monument, almost 2 million acres to be protected in San Juan County. And so I would keep an eye on that, because I suspect that there will at least be some discussion of that in the coming months.
I'm not done yet. Okay, that's the phrase we're going to keep looking for. Marissa Lang, your pick?
Well, Robert just stole mine, so I'm going to draw attention actually to something we did report. I don't know that it has legs or we're going to hear about it in the future, but it's interesting and it's happening today. It's the historic meteor shower that we might have a chance to catch a glimpse of today, and Sheena McFarland wrote a story about that and has all the details about where you can go and what you should be looking for, and I'm really excited. So
when is this happening?
It's happening tonight, I believe, and you know, I love watching cosmic happenings. I just think they're fascinating.
All right, so keep your eyes on the skies tonight. My pick is, I want to hear more about this, actually. It's a story that our colleague Brian Maffley reported on, the Ute Tribe developing a natural gas plant, and I actually can't even remember where it is going to be, but I it caught my eye, and I thought, you know, we're going to hear more about this, because obviously the Ute Tribe owns a fair bit of land in the state of Utah, and they want to capitalize on that land. So I think that's one that's going to have legs, and I'll leave it there. And Robert Gerke, Marissa Lang, Mike Gorrell of the Salt Lake Tribune, thanks all very much for the time. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
My pleasure.
We're going to wrap up this week's conversation with Salt Lake Tribune columnist Robert Kirby. The newspaper, of course, regularly features restaurant reviews and fine cuisine, but Kirby says that one thing is missing.
This column was born out of a list that the Tribune ran about the 10 best foods or most popular foods in Utah. And I noticed missing on there, visibly missing, was the staple of early pioneers and mountain men, you know, jerky. And, you know, what? That's, you can't leave that out. And I also felt that way because I make it.
What kind of world do we live in without jerky?
That's
huh?
right.
You make jerky. Is it tough?
Yeah. Yeah, a little bit. Depends on how you make it. I've tried various recipes over the years.
Well, we're going to have to get that recipe. But I do want you to read a bit of this column.
Sure. It's simply a fact that jerky is tougher, more nourishing, and tastes better than all of that other stuff combined. Early Mormon pioneers lived on dried meat when they ran out of crickets and seagull lily roots. The beauty of jerky is in its simplicity. An idiot could make it. I do it all the time. Basically, all that's required is some meat, a heat source, and any kind of spice except cilantro. sugar sprinkles don't work very well either. The finished product is so tough and dangerous looking that it could easily put your eye out. In fact, there's probably a TSA rule against having it in your carry-on bags. Although beef is the most common form of jerky, elk is also popular. So is deer, buffalo, goat, and possibly even donkey. You can, I've heard, jerk bat, lizard, seagull, and even a relative.
Ew.
Ew, yeah. How do we get back on goats again?
Let's.
Actually, you can't jerk human beings because there's too much fat in the meat.
Oh, well, that's a nice little trivia piece to know.
I guess.
When was the last time that you made jerky?
Last year. Yeah, I usually do it in the summer because you have to put the dehydrator out in the garage because my wife won't let me bring it in the house. She says it smells everything up. She's right. But I'll put it out in the garage, and there'll be 8 dogs sitting outside the garage in the morning. And it takes anywhere from 24 hours to 48 hours, depending on how thick you cut the meat. And then you just season it to taste. And you stick it in your back pocket and use it for a wallet for a while if you need to.
Not a vegetarian recipe, I guess?
Oh, no. I've never seen vegetable jerky before. I suppose they make it. I mean, they make everything else. Meatless hamburgers. Seriously?
You're sticking with the meat.
Yeah, I'll stick with the meat, yeah.
That's Salt Lake Tribune columnist Robert Kirby. He joins us each week with the best from the archive, and you can also find his current columns on the website sltrib.com. That's it for this edition of Behind the Headlines. The show is produced by the Salt Lake Tribune with technical support from Tyler Ford and Jesse Ellis. I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce with the Salt Lake Tribune. Thanks for listening. Have a great holiday weekend.